Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Republic Forces Radio Network. I'm Jerry, and we're here this week to discuss the second episode of Season 5, A War on Two Fronts. And I am joined by a entertaining cast of characters. We have Nathan P. Butler.
Hey, guys. Nate here from Star Wars Beyond the Films. Check us out at StarWarsReport.com.
And we have Barrett.
Hey, everybody. MCA on the forums, your Swan Holocron Enhancer. And I think that's the first time you ever called yourself Nate, Nathan.
That could very much be true. My fiance is changing my name, apparently.
The better half. They do make us better.
And last but not least, we have Jonathan.
Hey, everyone. And since everybody else is saying what else they do, make sure you check out On the Pegs on the Swan podcast.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, like I said, we're here for the second episode of Season 5, A War on Two Fronts. Guys, let's go through that same order, and why don't you just share your initial thoughts of how you'd like this week's episode?
Well, you know, being a EU guy myself, I really like the fact that we had a big EU reference. In fact, in this case, in terms of the place where it's all taking place, we've got Onderon here. I like the setting, like the new characters. They, you know, they played up the teen angst thing a little bit, but it wasn't like it was something that we were hit over the head with that we didn't expect once Lux was back in the picture. So I think, you know, even if it went a little on the angsty side, I think it turned out rather well. I mean, I'm interested to see where this goes as it gets more action-y the next episode or so.
You know, I think this season has two advantages going for it, because I really enjoyed this episode. And I started thinking to myself, if it wasn't for the fact of the episode that we got just last week, would I be so enthusiastic about this week's episode? And I think that we are getting used to, by this season now, you know, we've kind of know what to expect when it comes to the Clone Wars. And I think that the second thing that it's got going for it, I think it's got momentum going for it, just kind of like an election does. You got a candidate that could get some momentum, and then he can't do no wrong. So I think that with those two things, I really enjoyed this episode. There was a lot of good character moments. We've got a couple new characters that were introduced here that I really enjoyed. And I'm very excited to see what this arc's going to offer in the future.
And I really like this episode as well. This is really kind of what I was looking for originally when the Clone Wars began. I mean, this is the Clone Wars. This is the Republic and the Separatists really fighting over planets and trying to establish themselves. And the idea that the Republic is sending in essentially special forces and advisors to help train the locals to fight off the Separatists, it fits in really with, I guess, my perception of what I wanted to see.
All right. Yeah, guys, you know, it's what I find interesting about this kind of episode, since we know we're in these four episode arcs, I find it difficult to really evaluate one of these opening episodes, you know, because not really anything happened in this episode. It's just all set up, which is cool. I got to admit, the setup was enough to draw me in, get me engaged, get me interested in the new characters. But so far, I don't know if I can really say that, oh, I like this episode. This is one that I'm just going to have to wait and tie it into the other episodes. I certainly didn't dislike it. I mean, I think the episode did a great job of setting things up. And now it's like, okay, we got to wait till next week to really figure out what's going to happen, which is fine. I think this is one of these type of things that's showing me that when these episodes show up on Blu-ray and I can sit down and choose to watch all four in one set, that it's going to be dynamite, which is the feeling I'm getting so far. Yeah, but Barrett, you mentioned it correctly. We are starting off with some new characters and a new planet. But before we get there, we saw the Jedi Council talking a little bit about how they should handle the Onderon situation. We see the council meeting and talking with Lux Monteri, along with a couple of the other, oh, I don't know, are they insurgents? Are they rebels? Are they terrorists? What do you guys think about the setup there? There was quite a bit of a political perspective, point of view, differing point of views, if you will, on how, you know, societies and governments in flux, how you see things like that. What'd you guys think about that kind of setup?
I enjoyed that, actually. I thought that I guess it isn't what I would expect from, you know, a cartoon series, that they're taking this from different perspectives. Anakin sees these people as insurgents. Obi-Wan says, well, they could be seen as terrorists and we don't want to support terrorism. You know, it kind of takes it to maybe another level. It seems very, I don't know, poignant when you look at, you know, this country historically.
I think also, I mean, seeing this in Star Wars, I mean, this is kind of what the Clone Wars did a lot, you know, trying to give us all these different perspectives of what is good, what is evil in a time of war. It's just that most of that has been done in the books, you know, things like Shatterpoint, rather than being done in the cartoon series. But I will say, kind of as a side note, as an aside, that I do think that this episode has managed to prove my point last episode about how unimpactful Adigalia's death was, because here she is on the council somehow. But that's a thing for Continuity Corner. It is a great idea, though, to go into this idea of terrorism versus freedom fighting. You know, you could go back to something like, you know, back during the Cold War, things like us helping the Mujahideen, essentially training Osama bin Laden, and then he winds up coming after us later on. And I think that is sort of what they're going for here, because you get down to it, and even the episode guide on StarWars.com refers to the idea that this is sort of the beginning of the rebellion, in a sense that the very tactics that Anakin is pushing are going to be the ones that are used by the Rebel Alliance later, and this is where some of them learn those tactics. So it's very much that whole, you teach someone new tactics, expect them to possibly bite you. You know, we help Iraq during their war with Iran. Now, shortly thereafter, we have Iraq as an enemy in two wars, Gulf War, and then, of course, the most recent conflict there. So it's great to see those types of perspectives. I hope they don't drop the ball on it. I hope this does stay something that is somewhat morally ambiguous, though I have to ask, and I'm sure we'll deal with this later on in the episode too, at what point is it okay for them to get involved? Because this whole thing is the, we can only protect you or help train you. We can't fight a war for you. Well, that's lovely and all. But on how many planets have you already come in and taken a side? And is the difference here the fact that the government chose to side with the separatists? So that's why you can't come in and actively fight? You can only do some things to aid the rebels who are there? And if so, what if this was a more strategically important planet? Would you then go in not caring whether the separatists are in charge legitimately or not? It seems like there's way too many times where this moral ambiguity hasn't been there for them to now sort of spring this on us. I love the fact that it's there, but it really is something that seems like it's almost out of place in terms of the way that they've approached things before. You know, oh, we need this planet, we just go take it. Now, not so much.
So, Obi-Wan, I suppose if Onderon was supplying us oil, you'd all be in favor of going back after and saving them, right?
What I saw in response to that is, I'm not sure that the Jedi and the Republic went and said, Onderon is strategic, we need to go after it and take it. It was more Onderon contacting them asking for help, right? Or the insurgents asking for help. And then they have to go, well, this is the legitimate government, you know, has decided to side with the separatists. And, you know, we're not going to commit, you know, battalions or forces to take this world because we have no use for it at this point. But the question that I had through some of the conversations that were had in the episode, and maybe you guys can help sort of clear my thought process on this. They allied with the separatists at the outset of the war, but there was something said by Saw that the current king was actually a pretender to the throne, or somebody who was placed there as a separatist puppet. I'm to assume that that was done before the outbreak of the Clone War.
Yeah, it clearly sounded like he was corrupt, and however he got into power, it was just so that he could get them all aligned to the separatists. Now, Baron, have you had a chance to talk on this topic?
Yeah, I think, you know, I kind of got the feeling that their king was silenced around the same time that maybe Lux's mom was silenced. You know, they were kind of taking out leaders at the same time. But Nathan and Jonathan, you do bring up some good points. And I really like this scene, not only because of the real world aspects, as far as insurgency and rebels and are these terrorists. And, you know, these are some of the things that our government and other governments are doing and have done in the past. Now, you help the rebels, you know, hit soft targets so you can continue to engage the real enemy, the major enemy on the battlefield. So I really like that. But I also like the Star Wars in it, where Nathan, you had said, is this supposed to be the start of the Rebel Alliance? And if it is the start of the Rebel Alliance, then it's really got major connotations to it. This is where, like you said, the training starts.
And if that is the case, then you sort of have some irony here, because here we have Anakin setting up and pushing some of the different strategies that will eventually be used against the Empire that he is then part of the control structure of. But that's the same kind of thing we get with the Force Unleashed, where in trying to essentially create a plot to bring together the Emperor's enemies, using Starkiller, they managed to essentially create the Rebel Alliance, or at least take the people who would have been against the Emperor anyway, bring them together and forge them with the Corellian Treaty into one unified threat. So in a sense, they're sort of rehashing that same idea of the hubris, the pride of one winding up being something that can be used against them in the future, in Anakin's case.
Well, I think just in general, it's really fascinating to see that obviously there is kind of a tie-in for me to see an Anakin's point of view here is not terrorist, but a insurgency, a rebel, because he's decided that, hey, it's clear. And I kind of agree with him on this part. It's like, hey, the members of the plan are telling us that it's a corrupt government, that they were essentially manipulated by the separatists all along, and there is a separatist force on that planet. Thus, I don't know why the Republic and the Jedi would have any issue to saying, hey, well, we're going to go in there and attack the separatists on a planet that they've aligned themselves with, whatever. You just became an enemy of the Republic, so let's go. Remember Anakin, though, from episode 2, I think it was specifically, where he says, well, he's talking with Padme and said, well, who's going to decide what's right? Well, you know, not me, but someone should make them agree. You know, Anakin's kind of playing this that, well, it's okay to do it here because I say so or I think so. And he kind of convinces Yoda. Yoda goes from, oh, this is terrorism. And I think I didn't write down the exact quote, but he does say something to the effect that the Jedi must stop those who spread terror. But then they kind of go along with it. Obviously, Anakin as Darth Vader, though, is going after rebels because, in his mind, the Empire is doing what's right. So yeah, he is playing this, I decide at a whim on when it's okay and when it's not. So I think that's kind of an interesting tie into who he is and who he becomes.
You know, and the other point that I like about this scene is that in episode 3, we know that the Jedi are not getting Emperor Palpatine's consultation on a lot of their decisions. And this is a major decision that they're making to train these rebels. And they did not ask for the Supreme Chancellor's opinion. You know, they're doing something on their own unilaterally. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
I think that goes with something that we've been seeing all along, Barrett, is the Jedi obviously don't trust Palpatine. They're going to tell him absolutely what they have to, but I don't think they're going to volunteer any information. And if they decide to do something that they don't feel they need to, you know, consult him, because really the only thing, the only real, you know, true Republic force that they use is Rex. And you also notice that he isn't wearing his traditional clone armor. They want to almost distance themselves from Republic interaction here.
How interesting was that? I didn't even recognize him at first. I took down a note that said, oh, that was Rex. And then I also wrote that, hey, I'm sure Barrett's going to want an action figure of this Rex variant.
Oh, you know I do. There's a whole list of action figures from last episode and this episode. There is some great action figure creature possibilities in this episode.
I will say it's very nice to see that Ahsoka's wearing a cloak.
This is true. And actually, did any of you guys watch the commentary on StarWars.com about this episode?
Well, of course we did, Nathan, but what specifically caught your attention?
The commentary has a lot of Ashley Eckstein going through, and she's talking about how Ahsoka views Anakin. You know, we're talking about how Anakin sort of takes this idea that he is the man in charge, and he gets to decide to a degree, like, what is a terrorist, what is a freedom fighter, for instance, and when this is okay. And while you could take some of these, you could sort of see a dark road that they could go down in the idea of supporting groups like this, because what if they turn out to be more terrorist than rebel? She's looking at all these positive things in what it is that Anakin is doing. Like, this is, in her way of looking at it, the voice actress's way of looking at it, she says this is essentially where you start to see Anakin as he's moving off toward a somewhat darker extreme in some cases. She's always seeing the more positive side of it. So that as he's heading towards episode 3, you know, we always talk about how what makes an interesting villain is how they can essentially rationalize their things to make themselves into a hero. At least for right now, it's those heroic qualities she's seeing in him, not where it could go in a dark way.
Okay, well, let's get into our new characters that we met on Onderon. So we are introduced to Steela and Saw. What'd you guys think of, I guess, their brother and sister? I didn't actually put that together until I saw their names on the StarWars.com. But what'd you guys think about the Guerreras?
Well, I think Saw is your typical alpha male. I mean, we hear from his sister that he basically elected himself to be in charge, and he kind of tries to prop himself up by cutting down Lux a couple of times. As far as Steela, I think we've got a little interesting dynamic between her, Lux, and Ahsoka. And we saw Ahsoka getting a little jealous, and we definitely saw Steela getting a little jealous. So I'm interested to see how that plays out through the rest of this arc.
Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic because Lux is at the center of all this. I mean, Lux is certainly our entry point into this world because we know Lux. We know who his mother is. And I guess I don't remember. Did we know that she was a senator for Onderon? Was that mentioned in the earlier shows? I don't really recall that. Or was she just a senator from somewhere?
It was never openly stated that I saw. I found that kind of surprising.
Yeah, so he's our entry point to where there is a little bit of the love triangle, if you will, with Steela, Ahsoka, you know, sort of all competing a little bit for the attention of Lux. And then you got Saw, who wants to just knock Lux down and say, hey, you're the politician, you're not really a soldier, get out of the way, boy, let me show you how it's done, etc., etc. So kind of an interesting little mini soap opera in the middle of our training session. So interesting to see where it'll go. What'd you guys think?
You know, I really enjoyed these characters, especially Steela. The voice actress that was doing her voice, you could really hear the inflection in her voice, especially at the point where Ahsoka says, we need each other like we did on Kallak, I think they said. And she goes, what happened on Kallak? You know, can you hear it in her voice? And she says, you know, Lux tells her that Ahsoka's the reason I'm here and not with Death Watch. And she's like, really? You know, and I could just kind of see the head roll. And you could close your eyes and hear that. And that was pretty good. I did not like the fact that Saw, I just couldn't understand why he had to keep kicking Lux. Why is he keeping him down? I mean, Lux has chosen to come back there and help them. You know, what's the reason? If Steela is his sister, then there's really no triangle between them. And the only thing I could think of is that maybe he's scared that Lux could become the leader, could be the real leader that the people around him would elect, and not just the de facto leader that Saw is, because he wanted the job that nobody else would take. So I think that's probably going to work itself out. We could kind of see how Lux was proving himself that he could learn fighting techniques with the ball rolling and things like that. So I think that's going to work itself out. But that's really, I didn't really understand the need to keep Lux down, because we like Lux. As you said, Jerry, he's our entry point into Onderon, into these rebels. You know, we like Lux, and it just kind of hurt every time that, you know, he's a nice guy. He's not trying to, but I did like the fact that he did get up and get in the guy's face. You know, he wasn't kind of like getting bullied around. He would stand up to him.
Barrett, there's some things you said that triggered some thoughts for me. You know, Lux is the politician. Who got him into this mess? A politician. You know, maybe we're seeing some character development type moments to where Saw is just really against the whole politician type thing. You know, it's a crooked politician got us into this mess with the king. And, you know, likewise, maybe it's just the coming of age for Lux. I mean, maybe Saw has given us the perspective that says, hey, he's not ready to be a soldier, but maybe by the end of the fourth episode, maybe he'll be the soldier. So maybe this is just setting up some character development that we're going to see as the arc proceeds.
Well, we do have some background, at least, though, thanks to the episode guide and whatnot, as far as Saw and his sister Steela, that sort of puts into perspective, I think, why he'd be so distrustful of Lux in the first place. Saw was a follower, a very loyal follower, of the previous king. King Ramses Dendup was his name. And Dendup eventually was essentially, he tried to keep Onderon out of the Clone Wars. And eventually, they get sort of pulled into it because Dendup gets essentially ousted, and you have a new king that comes in, the one that we saw in the opening, Sanjay Rash, who's not named in the episode, but he's named in the episode guide. And when he takes over, he tosses them over to the Separatists, and essentially he's a stooge, he's a puppet and whatnot. But then you sort of take that one step beyond, and okay, he's the ruler on Onderon as a puppet, but what was Mina Bonteri? She was the separatist senate or separatist legislature representative for Onderon. And now that she's gone, we now have Lux taking her place in terms of representation, or at least he was for a little while there, which starts to beg this question of, it's not so much the politician's thing, it's the separatist thing, I would say. I mean, Lux, by joining now to try to free the planet from the separatists, he has not only sort of turned his back on his own people at one point to go towards the separatists because that's what his mom was doing. Now he's sort of spun around. He has his own bone to pick with Dooku. He's got his own bone to pick with the separatists. So now he's back to try to free Onderon. But given the fact that he at one point would have been much more associated with separatists than Onderon itself, you could see why someone like Saw would have some issues trusting him. And, you know, you get your historical parallels tying into these two. I would bet money that Saw and Stila Guerrera are meant to be name plays on Che Guevara. And in that sense, in Argentina, you get this idea of sort of the Marxist revolutionary and the way that they look at, you know, the outsiders and the puppets and that sort of thing. So it seems to me much more that Lux, yeah, he may not have earned all the bad blood that he's getting to a degree here from Saw, but he certainly, by being so associated with his mother, who was so associated with the separatists, who, to Saw's mind, are an illegitimate government over his planet, that of course there's going to be some distrust there. The fact that they're willing to fight alongside him at all surprises me. I would have expected Saw to just shoot him on sight if he was as fervent a follower of the previous king as he says he is. Be interesting to see how it was that Lux returned and ingratiated himself to these rebels to be able to be fighting with them as opposed to being their prisoner.
And we don't know who Lux's daddy is. You know, he could be the king's son. It could be the king and his mother. You know, this is just speculation on my part, but we don't know who his father is. You know, maybe it goes way back to having beef with his father, but there is a certain dynamic there that will work itself out in this arc. And I think that we're going to have a lot more discussion about those two guys getting along, because they're going to be the future. If their rebellion and insurgency is successful, they're the ones who are going to be running that planet, that country, the area, whatever. So they're going to have to learn to get along and work it out in some way.
Well, and that's going to be very interesting. I wonder if we'll see it play out to its ultimate conclusion. If they do break free from the separatists in this arc, you know, Lux comes out and says, I won't join the Republic. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that part plays out. So, well, moving on a little bit, let's get into the training. We get I'd be honest with you, I kind of thought about this at a 80s action movie montage sort of way of them like prepping and training. And that's not exactly what we got, of course. But, you know, Rocky IV went through my mind of like how they're training and working hard and learning things about the droid army, which I have to admit, I'm not a huge like essential guide to technology and weapons type of guy. But I kind of thought it was really interesting, especially on the destroyer droids, learning about what works and what doesn't. What'd you guys think about the whole boot camp sort of thing that the Jedi put on for the Onderians? Onderanians? What are they called?
The Onderanians. That's what I would call them.
The Ondors?
The Ondinians. I like the training exercise, and I like the way they did it. You know, they kept it serious and real, because they could have went the terrace on monkey bars bit. You know, they could have totally did that in the background and that could have went a whole nother way. But I like the way they did it. And we've seen these techniques that Ahsoka has done. I mean, I think on Landing at Point Rain, didn't she do these techniques where she took out a tank? Or, you know, it seems to me, if we have not seen these techniques, it seems to me that we did. And they've kind of brought in the real world fighting and how you would fight these things and defeat them. You know, Obi-Wan says it in the beginning, we're not here to fight your war, but we're here to teach you how to do it. What does he say? Successfully and in the most efficient way possible, or something like that. And I like the fact that they brought in techniques that I think we've seen, and you're teaching these rebels, you know, how to defeat these droids.
And maybe I like this montage bit as well. The only thing that I got to say took me out of it is when Rex kind of does the flip up on the turret. And I'm like, wow, he's got some Jedi in him.
The backflip off the tank was better than the flip up.
But, and the other thing with the tank is like, wow, I didn't know the front opened like that. But again, it's a necessary scene. We, you know, these are all things that we have seen before as far as like weaknesses in the separatist technology. But to be honest, I think we maybe could have dealt with a little bit more of this and seen a little bit more competition, maybe Lux, you know, he still has some issues with the Republic. And I would have liked to have seen maybe some resistance to training with maybe the other Jedi as opposed to Ahsoka, and then Saw kind of maybe modeling himself a little bit more after Rex. And again, I'm just injecting what I would have liked to have seen, but what we got was good.
I like the whole idea of the, and you see this a lot in different science fiction franchises. I know it showed up in Star Wars every great once in a while, but it's certainly not something that's used extensively. The idea of, you know, what does a shield actually do? What does it actually protect you from? And the idea being here that, you know, you can roll slowly enough, you can roll a thermal detonator, it'll pass harmlessly through the shield because it'd be the same thing as, you know, the shield trying to go forward into another rock, you know, or something laying on the ground. Slow moving passes through, fast moving is deflected, you get that slow moving detonator in there, and boom, you can blow up the droid. That's not something that we've seen a whole lot within Star Wars in general, but it's certainly a sci-fi trope that is kind of cool to see here. It's one of those things that for a long time, in looking at big battles and such, especially those who play the role-playing game, have kind of come down to the, okay, wait a second, can't we use something else? If it's meant to deflect energy, can't we throw like a spear at it or something? Can we drop a boulder on it? If a boulder drops on it, does it crush it, or does it somehow roll off the shield? What exactly is this shield supposed to do? What is this tech meant to be? I like the fact that they're using a little bit more of a specific definition of the technology to create these new, well, new, in this perspective, tactics.
Did you guys ever play that game at amusement parks or carnivals to where you got like a bowling ball and you have to roll it up these like metal rails?
Ball.
Well, no, not skee ball. It's like a bowling ball, and you've got to kind of push it up these metal rails, and it's got to go down, and it's got to land in the valley. So if you push it too softly, it doesn't make it up the hill. And if you push it too hard, it goes beyond the valley and then has enough momentum that it comes back to you. Only when, if you do it just right to where it lands in the valley. Certainly, if the game's got a name, I can't think of what it's called, but it's at every silly amusement park and carnival around there. That's kind of what I felt like I was watching with, okay, no, just roll it just right, put a little shoulder into it. And, you know, you had Saw, who was all bad dude, and hey, let me show you how it's done, and bink, the thermal detonator's blowing up in his face instead of inside the destroyer. So, although I guess they weren't thermal detonators, they're droid poppers. So I guess maybe after they realized how effective they were against General Grievous, they're just all carrying them now.
I think they probably just used those for practice, because otherwise the trainees would have all killed themselves.
I love the fact that they have these droid poppers. I mean, this is just like, this is another Star Wars thing that they're bringing back, is like, you know, you have this big old Death Star, but you have this 2-meter port where if you send a rocket down that port, it'll blow up the whole thing. Well, you have these destroyer droids where Obi-Wan says nothing short of a tank can get through these shields. But if you roll this little ball just slow enough to get next to them, it'll shut their whole system down. I love that. That the people in power, the future empire, you know, they're making things with these weaknesses that can be exploited. You know, they're not all powerful if you know what you're doing.
Now, Jerry, I looked that up. It's called Roller Bowler, apparently, is what that game is. But no, I will say along the same lines, though, yes, they've got these droid poppers. They can use them on the droids. But when a phalanx of droids is marching toward them, you notice in that last battle, they're pretty much using nothing but regular live explosives. What happened to the droid poppers?
Rex didn't hand them out.
They only brought training modules to where they don't really work.
Now, those explosives that they threw at the end, those were called, at that battle when they invaded their base, they called them disruptors, right? Is that what they called them?
Yeah, which is not a name that's ever been associated with an explosive in Star Wars that I know of before.
No, I mean, and they really look like just a whole bunch of TNT taped together, but. And then, of course, the droids look at him and go, what is this, an explosive?
Okay, that was dumb. To tie into sort of the final battle here before they, you know, enter the city, but we got a couple interesting original trilogy references. I mean, I'll gloss over kind of the obvious one. You know, Steela is showing, hey, what I'm really good at is using this weapon. She's showing how she can shoot, and the heads of the battle droids, especially when Ahsoka's moving them. And what does Anakin say? Impressive. Most impressive. Anyway. But you know what I really liked? What I really liked as an OT reference was the probe droids from Hoth. I mean, you got all the sound effects. They look like a early generation of a probe droid. I thought that was kind of cool.
Now, we've seen those before. We saw those, the same episodes as the Lerman in the first season, right?
Yeah, but these probe droids were depicted a little bit different. They were a lot more bug-like than we've ever seen them before. They were in the jungle kind of buzzing around, and their kind of sound was more kind of droid-y like, and it was more organic, like a buzz buzzing around when they were in groups of three, kind of in that synchronization, kind of how bees fly and stuff. And did you notice that when they had the droid's perspective, the probe droid's perspective, when he's kind of looking out at them, it was honeycombed. Where in the movies, when we would have a droid perspective, I think we at least we had one, it was more, or maybe that was just somebody looking through viewfinders, but I always thought it was more computer-like, you know, kind of like an Iron Man kind of tech, but this had a honeycomb tech to it. So they were portrayed more bug-like, if we have seen these before. So these might be a different type of pro-droid just for the jungle.
These look, they look to me the same as the ones we saw in Defenders of Peace, in the Ryloth trilogy, in the box where we had, you know, Obi-Wan undercover and such. I mean, this, it seems to be the exact same design. I mean, they may have changed out some of the equipment from it, but the character model or whatever you want to call it, since it's a droid, pretty much the same.
Well, it might be the same droid. I think I have to agree with Barron that it looks better. It's moving better, I think, but I think some of that could be attributed to the progress they've made in producing the shows.
You know, I don't remember them specifically from the Lerman episode, but I mean, they're pulling the sound effects straight from Empire Strikes Back, and I don't know if they did that before, but either way, I just thought it was kind of cool to see. So
one thing that we sort of mentioned, but we haven't really focused directly on, is the whole aspect of Ahsoka and Lux and Steela, the little bit of flirting that you get between Saw and Ahsoka and such. For me, there was sort of just enough of that without going too far overboard. Granted, they could go overboard and have something in the next episode where somebody makes a stupid, boneheaded decision because of their feelings for somebody else. But here, it seemed as though it was just another layer of the characterization. It wasn't the entire point of the episode, but it's not something that just happens and all the other characters are oblivious to it either, because Anakin even asks, and I was kind of shocked that he did, you know, about whether she was getting distracted and such. So what'd you think of the handling? Was it done too low-key? Was it still too much in our face compared to normal? I liked it.
I thought it was a really good balance, and I'm going to kind of look at Star Wars precedent before. You could tell that there are feelings there, and although I'm not entirely sure where Lux's feelings are, but you can tell just by their actions, by the looks, by some of the language, that both Steela and Ahsoka have some type of feeling for Lux. It's more like Empire Strikes Back, Han and Leia, than Episode 2, Anakin and Padme, where they're just blurting it out and stating it. I think it is something that they can really build on in future episodes, and I really, really hope that they keep the kind of the light-handedness with it rather than, you know, switching over to the prequel way of dealing with it.
The one thing that I thought was kind of interesting about Saw is that I wasn't convinced that he was taking a liking to Ahsoka at all, but perhaps maybe he was putting that out there, like, hey, maybe you can help me as a way to, I don't know, maybe draw Lux away from Steela. Like, you know, if he doesn't really respect Lux very much as a soldier, and hey, he's just one of these politicians, I really don't want him messing around with my sister. Let's see how he reacts if I start putting the moves in on Ahsoka. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading in much into it. I mean, maybe Saw couldn't possibly know as much about the background with Ahsoka as that I would, and thus I'm reading into it. But I don't know. I guess I didn't really take it that Saw was doing anything other than just trying to get Lux's attention and maybe draw him away from the sister.
I don't know about Saw's the way he took it. I just kind of think he asked Ahsoka because he wanted a partner. You know, maybe he just thinks he's a smooth operator and he saw a pretty girl, you know, he's just trying to make her feel better. But I like the dynamic, you know, it's just right. I concur with you, Jonathan and Nathan. It was just right, but not over the top. And I like the way how Ahsoka handled it when she realized that Lux was kind of helping out and that Steela liked it. She kind of just said, oh, great. So she kind of just accepted it. And Steela, it's no secret how she feels about him. You know, she's mad dogging Ahsoka when Ahsoka's laughing and stuff like that. And it's just no secret. But Lux, his is the one. He is the guy that confuses me the way he handles it. He's got to know that these two girls are fighting over him, or will fight over him, or have the potential to do so. And sometimes he's over with Ahsoka. Sometimes he's over with Steela. Why would Ahsoka like this guy? I mean, isn't this the same guy that left her in space and ejected afterwards? After they, you know, she had saved him and he still ejected and left her out there? You know, isn't that, was that the last time they saw each other? You know, why would she still like this guy? Especially if he's obviously has some sort of history with Steela. But I just like the dynamic of it. You know, I like the fact that Anakin knows, you know, he kind of gives a little smirk and he doesn't say anything about it. So it's pretty cool. It really was just enough, but did not take away from the overall story of their rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, Lux is pretty oblivious. And it is sort of the same dynamic I had after episode 2 with Padme. I couldn't possibly comprehend why Padme, especially, you know, after everything that happened on Tatooine and the little outburst he had in the on the Lars homestead, you know, why she fell for him versus seeing him as like some big psycho. Here it's a little different. You would think that she would look at Lux as someone that, hey, I just have to keep rescuing him and saving him. And I don't know, maybe she's just, I don't know, going after that she thinks is not very obtainable. Like maybe she's keeping the whole Jedi, like, hey, I really can't fall for a guy. I really can't have a relationship, but I'll mess around with this guy. I'll flirt with him a little bit, because it's not like we could possibly get together anyway, because he's such a dweeb to begin with.
Well, how much exposure has she had to other, you know, males somewhat close to her age? We have to assume there's some maybe floating around in the temple, but she's a wartime Padawan, has been stated before. She's going with Anakin different places. And Lux is very much by circumstance wrapped up in the same sort of situations as she is. They even though, yeah, he's kind of out there and, you know, wouldn't be what you would think Ahsoka would gravitate to, but they do have connections. And also, Ahsoka has been portrayed as wanting to take care of people, you know, protect people. And she's had to protect Lux a number of times and might be kind of dealing with a little of a little transference there.
You don't think that it couldn't possibly be part of the fact that, well, I mean, we met Lux in the first episodes, the first storyline we got after the big time jump. So he was the first boy to ever pay attention to her boob window.
Completely possible, sir. Completely possible.
Just saying.
Okay. I think the last thing I'd want to discuss is, again, we stated earlier that the droids were acting maybe a little goofy again, and something that I'd hoped we'd gotten away from. I think we saw it again as the rebels are trying to make their way into the city when they, you know, are essentially bullied into letting Anakin, Obi-Wan, Lux, Ahsoka, and the rest of them into the city by, you know, people yelling, hey, we're trying to get in here. And they completely ignore the fact that they had no, you know, proper documentation to get in.
Well, and here's the thing that kind of frustrated me about that. It was kind of a weak ending. I guess you got to get into the city somehow. I think I would have preferred something a little bit more. Hey, let's sneak in, find the back door, crawl underneath. Although I guess those things have been done over and over again in the Star Wars universe. But you're right. The one thing that frustrated me, though, was they couldn't have scanned, identified. I mean, these are robots, right? They have access to the database. The recon droids just spotted these exact people. They don't have an identification, some way to say, hey, wait a minute, this is that Lux dude. And hey, that kind of, you know, there's a 90% match that's Anakin Skywalker. I mean, these people aren't hidden.
They're wearing cloaks, though.
They can't just see somebody in a cloak.
That's why I said a 90% match. I can't see his hair, but based on the cheek, the jawline, the nose, that is 90% likely to be Anakin Skywalker.
Or not even that. The protrusions on the top of Ahsoka's head that obviously aren't.
Voice match. Something. These are droids.
Well, I kind of gave it to them because, like you said, they did have to get into the city, and how were they going to do it? And they kind of tried to explain it. You know, they tried to hide their weapons with organic matter, which would kind of make sense that if you're doing a scan, and these droids might not be programmed to be so hard. You know, they're just kind of like babysitters. Who knows? You know, crowd control. One thing we've noticed is that the people in power are very, all the way from the Jedi to the Empire, when they're in power, they just don't fathom anybody getting past their defenses. So the droids were kind of why they were talking to each other, by the way, and not just sending each other signals. But when droids were talking to, you know, Grievous or somebody else, they have to talk. But why they were talking to each other and not just sending signals is one thing. But I kind of gave it a gimme. But they should be able to recognize by now, when the Jedi are out there with their cloaks on, they're always trying to be inconspicuous, but you're so conspicuous when you have everything covered. You're obviously trying to hide, and they never can get spotted like that. So, you know, I gave it to them as a gimme. They have to get into the city, and we did not want to see them have to get into some underground cave again.
How about just some forged documents? I mean, come on, something, because it really just... You look at them and you're like, okay, these droids deserve to lose the city because they're just too stupid.
Well, Jonathan, I think you're getting on the point that I was sort of poking at. It's just kind of lazy writing. That's kind of what we're ultimately getting at. It just really wasn't written well. It's kind of like, oh, we hit 19 minutes of the story we wanted to tell. We got to get them in the city. Okay, just have them bust through the front door and say, hey, we're supposed to be here. Okay.
At least they didn't have them start the next episode in the city without showing us and then had us have to read a web comic to know how the heck they got in there.
True that. That would have been awesome, by the way. At this point, they could just kind of make... I'd almost appreciate them laughing at themselves by doing things like that intentionally, but sadly, I don't think anything was intentional.
The only thing could have been better if, you know, one of the droids had to open a little window. Who are you? You know, open it.
or, you know, maybe a little, you know, doorkeeper like Jabba's palace.
That would have been cool, like another homage.
All right, well, guys, great conversation here, but before we wrap up, let us take a stroll down Continuity Corner Lane. Nathan, why don't you tell us what it is that we should know behind the scenes of this episode?
A War on Two Fronts was originally to be the season premiere. That was changed to put Revival in front of it, but this has led to two continuity issues, one minor and one potentially major in terms of episode order. The minor issue is Yoda. He appears here with his older character model, whereas his new character model made its debut in Revival. That's more technical than chronological, however. The major issue is Jedi Master Adi Gallia, appearing on the Jedi Council in this episode after dying last episode. The episode guide on StarWars.com states that the true chronological placement of this episode in relation to Revival has yet to be determined, though it does suggest that perhaps Adi in this episode will be retconned to be Stas Ali instead, who has not yet appeared in the series. For now, she remains Adi Gallia and an apparent chronological flub in the series. The planet Onderon here is a major inclusion in the series of something that has its origins in the expanded universe. Onderon was developed for the Tales of the Jedi comic book series that began in 1993. It was a setting for the first arc of the original Tales of the Jedi miniseries, now often called Knights of the Old Republic, but more accurately referred to as Ulic Keldroma and the Beast Wars of Onderon and the Saga of Nomi Sunrider, of which Onderon factored into the former tale that bears its name. It also appeared in later arcs of that series, along with in the later Knights of the Old Republic II, the Sith Lords video game, as a major planet location in the game, and as a pivotal place within Empire's End, the third part of the Dark Empire comic book cycle. Most of its appearances are ancient, though, making this Clone Wars era appearance interesting without having much chance of derailing previous continuity of the planet. They even stuck with the same capital city, Issus, from the comics and video game. Saw and Steela Guerrera are new characters, voiced by Andrew Cascino and Don Leon Gardner, respectively. Both of these voice actors are new to the series. Voice actor Jason Spisak has also returned to voice Lux Bonteri with a new character model, Rex's gear, and that of the Rebels are based somewhat on the Rebel indoor gear in Return of the Jedi. In fact, the episode guide suggests that it is this kind of hit-and-fade tactic that Anakin is pushing right now that will serve as the basis for the Rebel Alliance tactics later in the continuity. Onderon is known for its beasts, ridden by its citizens, and we are introduced to some reused beasts from previous episodes here, along with some new ones, including the Dalgo and the flying Ruping. Speaking of reuses from previous materials, both Anakin and Obi-Wan here reference the films, with Anakin's impressive, most impressive from The Empire Strikes Back, and Obi-Wan's echoing of Qui-Gon Jinn's distinction between protecting as opposed to fighting a war for someone, based on Qui-Gon's line from The Phantom Menace. But you didn't need Continuity Corner for that, did you?
All right, Nathan, thanks. Some really good stuff there. Guys, any final thoughts? Baron, why don't you lead us off?
Final thoughts. Well, we're in the city. Right? We're in the city. We've got a bunch of weapons that we didn't see, and we've got a plan. And we're going to take this king out, and we're going to take the Separatist forces out, and we're going to retake this city, right? We're going to see more of Ahsoka and Lux and Steela, and we're going to see if Saw is a real leader. And we're also going to see just how far Obi-Wan is going to let Anakin take this terrorist insurgency/rebels. I'm pretty excited what's going to come. I was not disappointed with this episode. I think it will stand on its own. I'm already seeing on kind of like Facebook and some other things where people were saying that when you compare this episode to the overarching story, you know, you'll like this better. But I like it the way it is now, you know, and I think you guys are going to find that this would be Senate Spy quality, possibly.
I think this was a really good foundational episode to this arc. I'm interested to see where it goes. I think that the characters are good. I think the storyline, well, it's been used before. I think it's maybe coming at it from a slightly different way. And I'm eager to see next week's episode.
Yeah, I think Jonathan nailed it. I mean, this is a nice starting point for a 4-episode arc. And having had the time to read some of the quick little, not really synopsis, but the little blurbs that TV Guide puts out and things like that, if anybody even reads that anymore. I caught them on Wikipedia myself. It's interesting where it looks like this arc is going to be going in terms of the power struggle within the Rebels, in terms of what's going to happen for the fate of Onderon, broadly speaking. I'm really excited to see the next three. If this is the weakest of the episodes because it was the one that had to set everything up, then I think we're in for a treat the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys put it perfectly. I mean, I think this has been an excellent first episode, and it's really intrigued me. I'm engaged with the characters, especially the new ones. And you know, that says quite a bit, actually, that, hey, two brand new characters on a brand new world that I don't have any familiarity with because I'm not, you know, I've not been exposed to specifically to its EU origins. But yeah, I'm ready to go. I want to see where this goes. I've got just one or two little nitpicks that I don't think is a big deal and will not impact my enjoyment of this episode or future episodes. And yeah, let's see where it goes. So well done. I think, you know, in my mind, I'd say season 5 or 2 for 2. So really, really good job to Filoni and the gang there, bringing us some good stuff. My one thing, and this has nothing to do with the episodes, but I keep confusing and hearing Alderaan anytime someone says Onderon, so I just really got to get used to that. I know better. I know they're not an Alderaan. It's just kind of funny. I just think it's kind of weird that they sound so similar. But okay, well, guys, great discussion. Look forward to it this time next week as we discuss the second episode in this arc, episode 3 of season 5, Frontrunners. We'll catch you then.
Take care, everyone.
Night, all.
Take it easy, guys.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Barrent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production. Copyright 2012. All rights reserved.